So Mickey Fulp, you are an exploration geologist. You're known as the mercenary geologist, and you have over 40 years of experience searching for and discovering deposits of base and precious metals and industrial metals and energy-related minerals all over the world. You're a seasoned writer and speaker. You often are interviewed about mining and geology, and you're an expert on the topic of copper supply and demand. So my question to start things off is there one surprising aspect of copper, whether it's copper's location in the earth or somewhere along its journey to us in society, that you feel like the average person does not realize but should, given its role in our society and how that will continue to grow?
Yeah, so I would add in, I've been a mining analyst for over 15 years now. So in addition to exploration geology, as I've gotten older, I moved in to the financial end of the business. So, and that segues into the fact that copper, which is the third most used metal on the planet, way behind iron ore, which has used 95% of the metal produced and used in the world is iron ore. Then comes aluminum, use a lot of aluminum, and behind that is copper. And we currently use 27 million tons of copper every year. So copper, anecdotally, is called Dr. Copper, and it is said to have a PhD in economics because it's a forward-looking metric, the demand for copper and the price of copper on the health of the world's economy. So if you read about copper, you'll hear this over and over again. They call it Dr. Copper with a PhD in economics, and it really is foreshadows the near-term health of the world economy. We use, as I said, 27 million tons of copper per year. Since 1900, the world's use of copper has had a 3.3% annual compounded annual growth rate. So year after year after year, with very few perturbations for 125 years, the world's used more copper. About 25% of that is used in electrical applications, building construction, automobiles, motors, industrial uses, equipment, etc. It is essential for the world's economy. One of the reasons why it increases every year, it's pretty obvious, there are 85 million more people on the planet every year, and 25% of those people go to bed in the dark and get up when it gets light in the morning. They don't have electricity, and copper is essential to transmit electricity. And as the world, especially in Eastern Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, becomes more and more electrified, the demand for copper increases. If you look at a chart of copper consumption per person in the world from 1950 to, say, 2020, it's increased from 1.3 kilograms. So for people that are not metric savvy, that would be about 3 pounds of copper. And it's gone up from 1950, and now it's 3.2 kilograms, which, doing the math on that, is about 7 pounds of copper. So not only is the world increasing in population, the annual consumption per person is increasing year after year after year as the world becomes more electrified.
Copper use is increasing. It has for the last 100 years. The world's supply, or the world's population, is increasing. The uses of copper are growing per person, up to 3 pounds. Did you say that's a year? That's 3 pounds a year that we use copper individually, right? As an average over the world?
No, about 7 pounds.
Okay.
3.2 kilograms, which is 7 pounds.
What are some of the other factors driving demand as you see it? Obviously, there's a lot of news. There has been in recent years with the renewable energy sector. How do you see that driving demand?
It's a minuscule portion of it. It always will be. So, you know, we're looking at this 3.3% annual growth rate in demand year after year after year. And if the electrical so-called green energy economy were to come off full blast, which obviously is not, can't sell an electric car other than Tesla in the U.S. now, because they just don't work. So that might up the demand on a yearly basis 3 or 4%, but that's pretty doubtful because people want to drive gasoline cars. They want to be able to, especially in a place like the U.S. with wide open spaces, get in a car and not have to fill up with gas except every 400 miles and not have to sit at a charging station for 20 or 30 minutes or longer with their electrical vehicle, assuming that there are charging stations, which there are not except for Teslas. So I don't put a lot of stock in this so-called new green economy being a significant increase in demand. It will certainly be an incremental increase, but, you know, the basic uses and demand for copper are way overwhelming to anything that would come from that.
Are there any other areas of the economy particularly that listeners might not be aware of or think of that are really driving the demand for copper, maybe new developments?
Well, there's been a lot of stuff made, a lot of news lately about AI and big data centers, and that certainly is going to increase the demand for electricity. And once again, you can't generate electricity without copper. You can't transport it. You can't transform it, if you will. You can't build a transformer from those big poles that carry electricity all around the U.S. and that's generally transmitted with big applications. That's aluminum, but you can't down drop that into buildings or houses or anything without transformers, and those are all copper. Motors are all copper. Lots of consumer products, industrial machinery, motors are wound with copper, et cetera. So,
okay. So as a society, we use a lot of copper. We're going to be using it even more. Does that cover the demand side of things? Is there anything else you wanted to add before you shift over to the supply curve?
No, I think that would cover it in a nutshell. Let's go over to the supply side. So, and we'll focus initially on the U.S. U.S. uses about 1.8 million tons of copper per year. So in 2024, the U.S. produced 1.1 million tons of copper. And primary mine production, that comes from mines in Arizona, about 70%, Utah, big giant mine in Utah, we'll talk about in a bit, New Mexico, Montana, Nevada, some in Missouri, some from Michigan. We import 45% of the copper we use, so we consume 1.8 million tons per year, and those imports come from Chile, Canada, Mexico, and Peru. So those are stable sources. If you look at mined world production, I told you we use 27 million tons, but world production is 23, mine production's 23 million tons. We refine 27. Mine sources, Chile is the big boy, but they're decreasing. Lately, the Democratic Republic of the Congo has come on. They've got arguably the best copper deposits in the world, but severe geopolitical problems that kind of ebb and flow over the last few decades. Then Peru, then China, the U.S. So U.S. fifth largest producer. The sources of new copper, let's look, go back and say the new copper required per year to be mined just to keep up with what we have is equal to Bingham Canyon in Utah, which is the world's largest excavation. It's more than a mile deep, and it is a giant open pit mine that has been in production since 1880, and it produces somewhat on the order of 18 million tons a year. And so we have to find on a yearly basis that much copper just to replace the reserves that are mined worldwide. So lots of people have been to Bingham Canyon, or they've flown to Salt Lake City and they saw that. They've seen that giant hole in the ground. And so that's the task at hand. We need to find sources of new copper, and there's ways we can do that. There are many places in the world where there's copper to be found. Chile, Mexico, Peru, the Americas, Canada, U.S., the aforementioned Democratic Republic of the Congo, giant deposits waiting to be developed, but severe geopolitical risk. There's lots of copper undeveloped throughout the world for bureaucratic or geo-regulatory or geopolitical reasons. Giant deposits in Mongolia, ongoing problems with the big mine there. Pakistan, giant deposit. Iran, that's off limits, giant deposit there. So we're faced with the fact that we've got to find this amount of new copper every year. There are two sources in terms of what's mined, and that's sulfide copper and oxide copper. As we mine deeper and at lower grades, which is what's happening now, we have to keep finding bigger and higher grade deposits deeper. That's sulfide copper. On the oxide copper end, those are open pit mines that have a very simple metallurgy, copper oxides, and they're recovered by heap leaching with dilute sulfuric acid. But it makes sense, the fact that the sources of those are somewhat limited. That technology came around in the mid-1970s, so we're 50 years into that, and we do not have abundant new sources of oxide copper that can be mined in shallow open pits. So we're faced with drilling deeper, finding buried deposits. The other thing that might on the horizon is there's new technologies and innovations. And the big one there, and I think you mentioned that in your original email to me, was the leaching of primary sulfide copper. And engineers and scientists, research science, have been working on this for a long, long time. And there's been some recent breakthroughs where you can leach primary sulfide ores, which supply somewhere on the order of about 85% of the world's copper on a yearly basis. And so if we can get new technologies which allows leaching of that versus refining, pyrometallurgical refining, then we've got a new source of copper.
So demand for copper is growing. We're going to have to go deeper or look at the leaching option that you mentioned. Just the geology requires us to go where the copper is. So, but we can't mine it if we can't get it out of the ground profitably, right? So what trends do you see? You'd mentioned some of the countries where we currently mine copper. Where is exploration looking? You know, politically, where do you see as the most likely, most stable areas? What kind of trends do you see there?
Well, I see trends with more and more production, assuming that there is a stable government in the Congo. There are immense deposits there. You know, there's deposits all over the world. There's great deposits in Indonesia. Let's say the Southwest Pacific, East Asia, Southwest Pacific, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Congo, and Zambia, South America. You know, we still got good deposits being discovered, but they are deeper. They can be higher grade, not uncommon. The deeper you go, the higher grades you encounter, but we're talking really deep, like mile deep. So in those sorts of cases, you're faced with deep underground mining, deep bulk underground mining, which tends to be more expensive. And so we end up mining lower grades. And, you know, we've got great deposits in the U.S., a number of really significant world-class deposits that because of an anti-development environmental socialist agenda that has been in effect for 12 of the last 16 years. And during that period of time, there were no permits granted for any new mines in the United States, specifically copper mines. And there was a bunch of bureaucratic and regulatory and delays put into effect, mineral withdrawals, et cetera. So the real hope here is with a friendly resource development oriented administration that some of these deposits will be taken out of purgatory and developed. So you got two in Arizona. One of those is world class. The Resolution deposit is in central Arizona. It's deep. It's owned by Kennecott Rio Tinto. I think it was discovered well over 20 years ago, and it sits undeveloped. And the other one in Arizona, I wouldn't call it world class, but certainly a significant deposit, is Rosemont, southeast of Tucson. Two giant deposits in Minnesota, in a rock formation called the Duluth Gabbro. Those are copper, nickel, platinum, palladium deposits, two giant deposits that were basically vetoed by one way or the other with environmental regulations or flat out mineral withdrawals. In Alaska, you've got the Pebble deposit, which is a giant copper porphyry deposit. It has been in development purgatory for something well on the order of 20 years. Another problem with it is marginally economic. I'm not convinced it will be developed. But a company that I was involved in, Trilogy Metals, owns the Arctic and Bornite deposits in northwest Alaska. They had environmental impact statement fully granted to develop a 200-mile road into these two deposits. And as soon as Biden administration came in, within months of that, the environmental impact statement was arguably illegally rescinded. So those deposits sit, those are world class, high grade, I would argue the two highest grade copper deposits, world class copper deposits and world giant deposits. So since Trump has come in, that road veto is working its way out, and we're convinced that that's going to be get the go ahead, and those deposits will be developed. So in addition, there are many smaller deposits that have been put on the back burner for one reason or another, generally environmental issues. Sheep Creek in Montana, copper cobalt deposit, many smaller ones, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, Missouri, et cetera. So from that point of view, with a friendly administration, hopefully we'll get some of those well on their way to develop, you know, in the next 4 years and perhaps after that.
Yeah, you mentioned 12 years of unfriendly mining policies. I wonder if you could put this into context for the layperson in terms of mining's strategic nature. It's a very long-term endeavor. It requires a lot of investment up front. It's not a copper production, like any mineral that's mined, is not a spigot that can be turned on and off. You know, what do you want listeners to understand about that in terms of, you know, the lasting effects and long-term effects of unfriendly mining policies?
Well, it just makes the U.S. more dependent on other often unfriendly countries. So with copper, we're probably in better shape with copper because the places we get our sources, Chile, Mexico, Peru, Canada, are friendly countries. But still, you know, we would, year after year, the copper production continues to decline in the U.S. because we've, you know, we're mining deeper, we're mining lower grades, you know. It's not like you move the mine. The mine's where the deposit is. So we would like to produce more copper. It's to the benefit of the United States. And, you know, these are multi-billion dollar capital expenditures to build a big mine. Could be upwards of $5 to $6 billion. And it takes years to, when it takes years to develop, you know, we're looking at 15 to 25 years from discovery to actually have a mine shovel ready and producing copper and milling it and sending it to smelters. So,
and then how long do those mines stay in production?
Well, Bingham Canyon's been in production 145 years constant. The porphyry copper deposits in Arizona and New Mexico, both areas, 100 plus years. So, you know, we're talking giant deposits that continue to produce because as you mine, you in these giant, especially what's called a porphyry copper, which produces most of the world's copper, giant deposits, and that they keep discovering more and more satellite deposits or even larger deposits from the original and surrounding areas. So, you know, we're talking very long-term, long-lived mines.
So it sounds like a message for your average consumer or voter, is that for a mining company to begin exploration into a new source of copper, it requires maybe billions of dollars through exploration and then getting that mine into production. And then that mine may operate for decades. And so as a miner looks at the political climate, the social climate, social license to operate, those kinds of things. They're really trying to game out, okay, how stable is this investment going to be for years and years and years and years, right? And so that kind of, I think, helps listeners understand that 12 years of unfriendly mining policy is, you can't unwind that immediately. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, yeah, you've lost 12 years, so let's look at the one I'm most familiar with because I'm a shareholder and I covered the company in my newsletter for over 4 years, 4.5 years, which would be Trilogy Metals, owns these two deposits in Northwest Alaska. Very challenging, no road in there, needed to build a 200-plus-mile road to open up the district. But we're looking at mine lives on these things of initially you can see 20 to 40, even 50 years of copper supply in the area. So when you lose that much time, then you don't start over, but you've got to regroup and resume. So, for instance, I can tell you that Arctic, which is a giant copper, zinc, gold, silver deposit in northwest Alaska, west of Fairbanks, that deposit was initially discovered in somewhere 1976 or something. So we're looking 50 years later or thereabouts, and it still has not been developed.
This has been an eye-opening conversation as we kind of wrap things up. I wonder if you have any thoughts about, we hear a lot about tariffs in the news, resource nationalism. I was looking at Ernst & Young's 2025 Risks to Mining report, and they have geopolitics as the third highest risk. What do you see, as threats to supply? How do those factor into your thinking?
Well, certainly tariffs, price of copper's at a record. I haven't checked it today, but last I time by midweek it was $5.19. Now you have to do a constant dollar estimation on but still that's a near record price. Price it somewhere 4.45 or something within the last decade, but so those sorts of things increase the price, and it's like anything, these fundamental inputs, oil, iron, cement, copper, as they increase in price, then that's what really one of the reasons that for price inflation, not monetary inflation specifically, but price inflation. So, all in all, I'm bullish on copper. I'm what's called a cornucopian. There's the cornucopian philosophy and the Malthusian philosophy, and the Malthusians are the doom and gloom types, which who think that the world needs less people and more regulations, and that we're going to run out of this or that commodity. And fact remains that we've never run out of anything that we needed. We always find more, we find substitutes, with one exception, and that's bird guano. And we mined all that in the 1870s, and we didn't have a source of bird guano anymore. So that was the main way that people fertilize their crops. So what did we do? We went and we found nitrates in the Atacama Desert of Chile, and then in right before World War I, the Germans found a way to make nitrogen fertilizer from nitrogen in the air, make ammonium.
That's a good perspective to keep in mind. Yeah, resources may be scarce, but our technology and our efficiency of getting them out of the ground is growing and growing. So we're opening up new supplies. I want to be respectful of your time. I know you're a busy guy. And so I just thought I'd finish up with a couple of fun questions, if that's okay. I have a young listener who, in reviewing your website, had asked, why are you called the mercenary geologist?
Well, a mercenary is someone for hire, right? Not necessarily a soldier. It's often applied to the fact of a soldier for hire, but it's anybody that's for hire. So most geologists, and I, for three quarters of my career, I didn't have a real job. I go from contract to contract, job to job, consulting here or there. You know, I've worked in 31 different countries, so I'm truly a mercenary geologist. I'm a mercenary. I'm for hire, and if you pay me enough money, I'll probably go just about anywhere in the world to work.
Okay. Well, this young listener has one more question for you. What is the coolest place that you've ever been, or the coolest thing you've ever found as a geologist?
Oh, my. Geez, that's a difficult question. I've worked in 31 countries. One of my favorite places to work for years and years was the high Andes of Peru, very high, somewhere plus 4,000 meters elevation, 4 to 5,000 meters. So you're talking 13 to 16,000 feet elevation. So, I have very fond memories of working in those sorts of places.
Yeah, that's great. That's a beautiful area. Yeah, I've been down to Cusco and the Andes, and it's an amazing place. I can see why you would enjoy your time there.
So get this, I worked there off and on. And I probably have total, if you add it all up, around 4 years of working off and on in Peru for well over a decade, and I've been to the city of Cusco, but I never went up to Machu Picchu. So, not my style.
I've but you learned Spanish,
where,
right?
Where no one else has ever walked, probably, so.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing this information, this wisdom of yours gained over many years. What do you want listeners to know in terms of what you're up to these days, how to find you, those kinds of things?
Yeah, sure. My website's mercenarygeologist.com. During the pandemic and shortly, or the years after that, the mineral exploration business, the junior mining sector based in Vancouver, went on hard times. So basically, I semi-retired. I quit writing. But now with the price of gold at record high over 3,000, price of copper at record high over $5 a pound, I'm getting back into the business. I'm looking for companies and just follow me on my website, mercenarygeologist.com. We'll soon have, we've got a subscriber list, subscriptions free. You can join 7,400 subscribers. We will have that up and running here, hopefully within the next month. And for investors out there, I'm on a hunt for new companies to speculate in. These are not investments, they're speculations, but we want to make a few more people millionaires as we did during the good times in 2007, 2012, and then again a few times in 2016, 2017. So got a really good track record, and you know, I put my money where my mouth is, and so before I pick a stock, I'm a shareholder.
Well, that's exciting. If you want to get back into the game here, and if you'd ever like to come back on and talk about another area of interest, that would be fantastic. Again, I really appreciate your time. It was good catching up after all these years, and thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.